This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, an hour-length drama based on the John Galsworthy novel, The Patrician. And at intermission, a transcribed commentary on the works of John Galsworthy by the well-known producer, actress, and author, Margaret Webster. In connection with The Patrician, it is interesting to note that Mr. Galsworthy was a successful novelist for many years before he became a playwright, and that he wrote a goodly number of plays before the first was accepted for production. One explanation of his early difficulty as a playwright may have been that, as a novelist, he liked to describe his key scenes in narrative rather than have his characters act them out. This is most certainly true in The Patrician. And as a result, a good deal of the dialogue in today's dramatic version must be credited to the adapter, Richard E. Davis of NBC. Here now, The Patrician, by John Galsworthy.
As ever, in the old thatched cottage, there was a scent of wood smoke, flowers, and sweet briar. Silvery dun moths fluttering from the night-filled garden kept vibrating like a sponge shilling over a jade-green bowl of crimson roses under the lamp. The dark-eyed woman leaned back comfortably in her low-back chair between the two men, one young, the other past middle age, who, so extravagantly unlike, sat looking at each other like laboring dogs, who, realizing their differences, realize also that they have met at some spot where they cannot possibly have a fight. The young man is Eustace Viscount Milton, Conservative candidate for Parliament. The older man is Charles Courtier, radical leader and journalist who has come down to the country to speak on behalf of Lord Milton's opponent.
And so I'm sure you'll agree, Mr. Courtier. Your arguments on behalf of my opponent, Mr. Chilcox, amount only to a defense of the so-called liberal spirit.
And what is your objection to the liberal spirit, Lord Milton?
Oh, I fear that all this discussion is boring to our hostess, Mr. Courtier.
Not at all, gentlemen. I find it all very fascinating. Do go on.
Hear, hear, Audrey. You see there, Lord Milton, Mrs. Noel has the liberal spirit for you, and you say you don't like it.
The issues of government are larger than the conversation in this country cottage. In politics, I find the liberal spirit weak. It's an importation from the realms of philosophy and art, and it withers the moment it touches practical affairs. I'm sure Mrs. Noel will agree to that.
I really haven't given that much thought to it, but I dare say the voters have, and I'm sure they'll make a very wise choice.
Well spoken, my dear Audrey. But the charge deserves a more direct answer. Lord Milton, liberalism isn't always practical, but neither is your completely hidebound conservatism, for the completely unbending position you have taken as a Conservative candidate.
Indeed. And what brings you to that conclusion?
Because you will not compromise.
Compromise is completely foreign to my nature, Mr. Courtier.
And compromise is the very essence of politics and life itself. That's why high priests of caste and authority, advocates of non-compromise like yourself, Lord Milton, are every bit as much out of it as any liberal professor.
Hardly, sir. England will always need men of authority, men of principle who know their own minds.
Agreed, sir. But the death of your point of view lies in itself. It's too dried up and far from things ever to understand them. And mark this, Lord Milton, if you don't understand, you can never rule. You might just as well keep your hands in your pockets as go into politics with your notions.
I fear we must continue to differ, Mr. Courtier.
Well, perhaps I pay you too high a compliment, Lord Milton. After all, you are a patrician.
I shall take that as a compliment to my ideals. You're very kind.
Oh, dear, 10 o'clock. I have several speaking engagements tomorrow. And this meeting tonight, Lord Milton, has convinced me of the importance of a good night's sleep And sharp wits?
In view of that argument, I won't try to persuade you to stay. I'll get a lantern.
Well, I don't think that'll be necessary. Well, there's a pretty good moon.
Still, I'd better walk out with you to the road. The path's very dark. I won't be a moment, Lord Milton.
Good night, Lord Milton. It was a pleasure.
May I say the same, Mr. Courtier? Good night.
Well, Charles, what do you think of Lord Milton?
A most unusual chap. Have you known him long?
Not long, but he visits me quite frequently. Do you like him?
I think so. He's very sincere. Almost too much so for his own good. Is he, in love with you, Audrey?
I think he is. Is that a mistake?
In view of your rather special situation, I would say that depends on Lord Milton. He has a great many straight-laced ideas about life, as you've just heard. Have you told him about your husband?
We've never discussed it, but he must know. What are you getting at, Charles?
I don't want you to get hurt a second time, my dear. Apparently, you're the only woman Milton ever permitted to enter his life. Until now, his career has been the most important thing in his life, next to his family. Oh, by the way, have you met them, Lord and Lady Valley?
I've met his younger sister, Lady Barbara, on occasion while walking. She was very pleasant.
But you've never met his mother and father. The old boys in the cabinet, you know. Or the grandmother who adores him. He's never introduced you?
No, but I'm sure he will. I know what you're getting at, but I refuse to be apprehensive about the future. Good night, Charles.
Good luck, Audrey.
Even while Audrey Noel was flinging her challenge into the night after the departing courtier and making her way back to the cottage in Lord Milton, that young gentleman's future and her own as well were undergoing lively and apprehensive scrutiny in the London drawing room of Lord Milton's maternal grandmother, Lady Casterly, a tiny grey lady who was the steel spring inside the aristocratic body represented by Lord Milton and his father, the Earl of Valleys.
Geoffrey, I've decided that something must be done about Eustace and that woman.
What do you propose must be done?
That someone put some sense into his head before it's too late. Make sure that he doesn't fumble his chances for election.
Well, he's running rather a good campaign, all things considered, it being his first and all that. His chances for election are very good.
Precisely. And they mustn't be thrown away on that woman, Mrs. Noel. I've always held high hopes for Eustace. He's a born leader. One of the best our family's ever produced. Before I die, I mean to see him in the Prime Minister's seat. But it's an ambition that'll never be realized if his name is compromised with that divorcee.
My dear lady, Eustace is 30 years of age. I'm sure he's quite capable of taking care of himself.
Eustace is almost ascetic. He knows really nothing about women. In many ways, he's very naive. And we know what these women are. No concern for a young man's career. No background. But aggressive and clever. And this particular one, to complicate matters, I understand to be a close friend of that radical leader, Charles Courtier.
So I'm told. He's down in the country now, as a matter of fact. The Liberals brought him in to speak for Chilcox against Eustace. There may be trouble in that. Our village people aren't much fond of radicals.
But they are fond of Eustace. We can't afford to have anything jeopardize that.
Very well. What do you propose?
Well, since the election is only 2 days away, I've arranged to go down first thing in the morning. And it might be well if you went down tonight.
Oh, come now. Hardly tonight, do you think? It's almost midnight.
I'm quite concerned, Geoffrey. I wish I knew that Eustace were out of scandal's way this midnight.
Good heavens, Audrey, how the hours do fly. I should have left when Courtier did. It's midnight.
The witching hour is here, Eustace.
It holds no fears for me. I've already been bewitched, Audrey.
I like it when you call me Audrey. But I don't like it when you leave me all alone, Eustace.
I really should have left earlier.
But I couldn't bear the thought of tearing myself away from you.
Listen, what's that?
It's the dogs down in the village. Come and listen by the window.
So it is. I hear it clearly now.
Every dog in the village seems to be up in arms.
Well, something must be the matter.
There must be a demonstration in the village.
Look, men are running on the road.
Well, I'm going to find out what's going on. I say there, are you on the road?
Yes, sir.
What's going on in the village?
Can't know for sure. The earthen fella set out from the tavern to devil that radical fella.
That must be Courtier. What does he mean by deviling?
Well, a charming local custom, my dear. They lock a man in a room and blow red pepper under the door until he either breaks the door down or jumps through the window.
The cowards! Well, what can we do?
Well, I'm going down to the village.
And I'm going with you. Poor Charles.
Right, Courtier?
Oh, pretty much, Lord Milton. Except for having the wind knocked out of me.
Charles, what happened?
Well, those brave fellows ran off when your carriage approached. Decided they didn't like my political views. So shortly after I returned to the inn from your place, they deviled me out of my room with red-hot pepper. I had to jump for it out the window.
The ruffians! How terrible for you.
Are you hurt, Courtier?
I'll know a little better when I stand. Give me a hand up, will you?
Surely. Here we go.
Up. Ouch! Oh, my knee. Oh, must have twisted it when I jumped. I'm afraid you'll have to give me your arm back to the inn.
I'd be greatly honored, Mr. Courtier, to have you as my guest at home.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Lord Milton. But my presence, in view of my position as a radical leader, as they say, would be a source of embarrassment to you and your family.
Not at all, sir. I feel most responsible for this disgraceful behavior on the part of my villagers. You were their guest, and they behaved badly. Now, take my arm, Mr. Courtier, while I help you to the carriage.
Well, all right, if you insist. It's terribly decent of you, Milton.
We'll drive Mrs. Noel to her cottage, and then you'll come to my home. And you'll not leave until your leg's right and you're yourself again. Morning, Babs. You're up bright and early.
I took breakfast up to your friend, Mr. Courtier. He's such a darling, Eustace.
Indeed. I was just on my way up to look in on him. How is he this morning?
Oh, much better than when he hobbled in last night. At least he insists on getting about his business. So I'm going to drive him over to a meeting at the enemy camp. You should have seen the expression in Father's eyes when I told him what's been happening.
His father here?
Yes, he came down on the night train from London. I think he's got something on his mind, Eustace. He and Mother in the garden having breakfast.
Awfully glad you could get away, sir, before the election.
Yes. Well, I hear you're speaking at Easton today. I'll ride over with you. Few things I want to discuss with you.
I would like to have a little talk with you also, Eustace.
Oh, yes, Mother?
Early this morning, I came upon your sister Babs carrying a breakfast tray for a guest. And it was then I learned for the first time that you had brought Mr. Courtier home last night.
Well, he had a most unfortunate experience in the village.
Yes, we've heard all about that from Babs. She seems quite charmed with the idea of having a wounded radical about.
But I can't say that I'm very happy about it.
Well, Mother, it was the only sporting thing to do.
To be sure. But I find it most difficult to reconcile myself to the idea of having an enemy in our midst, especially right at election time. Your constituents might not understand.
I have never allowed myself to be influenced by public opinion. And I'm sure once my constituents learn the facts of last night's events, they will applaud my action.
Well, for your sake, I hope you're right.
That's easily said. But I do wish that Babs hadn't insisted on driving Mr. Courtier to his appointment. It seems to me that's carrying noblesse oblige just a little too far.
You
drive quite expertly, Lady Barbara.
Thank you, Mr. Cordier.
Why are you laughing, Lady Barbara?
I'm laughing at you.
Indeed.
Or perhaps I'm just laughing at myself. Because I can't get over the idea of your being such a gentleman.
I beg your pardon.
Please don't be angry. But you're the first radical I've ever met. Somehow I expected you'd be full of bombast and go around shaking your fist at people.
I think you'll find that radicals are very much like other people in the way they talk and eat and love.
Oh. Do you think my brother will win the election, Mr. Cordier?
Sure, I don't know. We've still a couple of speeches to go till the last ballot is counted.
My grandmother, Lady Casterly, says Eustace's hurting his chances by consorting with that Mrs. Noel.
Indeed.
Yes. Granny's even coming down from London for the election.
Well, your grandmother need have no fears about Mrs. Noel.
But she and Eustace are together so much. And you know how people are. They'll circulate stories even when they know they're not true.
Lady Barbara, I give you my word that false witness will not be borne against your brother in this political campaign. Not as long as I have my influence with the chairman of the Liberal Party.
Yes, but knowing Mr. Smythe, I feel he might use whatever ammunition came to hand.
In that event, I should disassociate myself from the campaign.
How sweet of you to hold personal honor above politics. Oh, where would you like me to drop you, Mr. Cordier?
Well, with my leg as it is, I'm afraid you'll have to deposit me right at the front door of Liberal Party headquarters.
Mr. Cordier, glad to see you. In one piece, sir. Have a chair. That was a bad go for you last night.
Those things will happen in politics, Mr. Smythe. It wasn't too bad.
It was a deplorable outrage. Though, in a way, the attack on you has done us good.
What do you mean?
Well, I shouldn't be surprised if the publicity will bring our candidate another 200 votes. Possibly carry the day, too, for the Liberal Party. The publicity should...
Be explicit, man. What publicity is this?
The article about last night in the Liberal paper.
Hmm?
It doesn't go on sale till this afternoon, but I've got a copy here. Here. See for yourself.
Outrage and distinguished visitor. Lord Milton's evening adventure. When Lord Milton rescued Mr. Cordier, his lordship was accompanied on his midnight adventure by Mrs. Audrey Noel. Why, this is infamous. Why have they dragged her name into it?
Oh, they make no imputation on the lady. Simply state the facts. Quite enough, though. I think Lord Milton's done for himself, sir.
It's a low outrage.
No, sir. It's just a plain piece of news. But one of those incidents where one benefits against one's will. The paper imputes nothing. It states. The position of a lady living alone does the rest. Can't help it.
Would you make political capital out of this incident?
If Lord Milton will spend his evenings with a lonely lady, he can't blame anyone but himself.
If you persist with this line of attack, I shall be forced to register a protest. This is not playing the game true blue, Smythe. The paper should be taken out of circulation.
Hey, whose side are you on, anyhow? Since when are you partial to the Conservatives?
This attack is not on a political level, but a purely personal one.
Personal level or not? Lord Milton can defend himself.
To be sure. But he won't see the paper until the damage is done. He won't be back here until nightfall. He has a speaking engagement in Eastham. And if you go ahead and let them put that story out before he has a chance to see it, I'll disassociate myself from the campaign.
It would be a shame for the party to lose you, Mr. Cordier. But then perhaps you would have more time to spend with your new friends among the opposition.
Well, Eustace, I think you did quite well in Eastham this afternoon. I was proud of you.
Thank you, Father.
One or two more rousing speeches like that, and I should imagine you'll have relatively little trouble in winning the election. Of course, barring those unforeseen difficulties, which are always a threat to every political candidate. You can't be too careful, Eustace. Mustn't play with fire.
What do you mean, sir?
To be perfectly blunt, your relationship with that woman, Mrs. Noel...
I don't choose to discuss the matter.
Even though it can ruin your career? Why can't you discuss it?
Well, I may as well tell you now, Father. I've decided to marry Mrs. Noel.
Isn't this rather sudden?
I've known the lady for some time. I've wanted to from the moment I first saw her.
Eustace, quite frankly, this is a piece of news I would rather not have heard.
Indeed? What's your objection, sir?
Well, you know as well as I do. We are both men of the world.
I am not.
So be it, but I am. And perhaps for that reason I have a better understanding of the implications of a marriage with a person such as Mrs. Noel.
Father, will you come to the point?
Well, she looks like a lady.
And she is.
But she's divorced. I thought you agreed with the church on the subject.
Well, she has done wrong.
Ah, then you know her story, these circumstances.
No.
Chivalry, the better part of discretion, eh?
Your questions are really insufferable, Father. I don't think you understand the kind of feeling I have for Mrs. Noel.
And I think you fail completely to understand what it will mean for a man in public life to marry a divorcee. It can ruin your career.
Well, I must be my own judge of that when the time comes.
Oh, hasn't Mrs. Noel accepted you?
I have yet to ask her.
Then there is still time for you to reconsider.
I think you'd be making a mistake if you thought of it in that way. My mind is made up.
Now, you mustn't upset yourself, Mother. Eustace and Geoffrey will be back from Eastham in a few hours.
I was afraid of something like this newspaper article, Gertrude. That's why I came down from London. To think that I would live to see the day that my grandson's name graced the headlines of a political scandal. Lord Milton's evening adventure. And the election coming up tomorrow.
Mother, please try to calm yourself.
Gertrude, do you think Eustace has any ideas about marrying this Noel woman?
Well, the thing of it is, I really don't know.
Why haven't you asked him?
That would be next to useless. You know he'll never discuss his ordinary affairs. What chance then of talking about his love affairs?
I wasn't speaking of love. I was talking of marriage.
Really, Mother, I'm sure that marriage is quite out of the question.
Precisely. And Eustace must be brought to see that. The preservation of our position as a class depends on our observing certain decencies. What do you imagine would happen to the royal family if they were allowed to marry as they liked? All this marrying with gaiety girls and American money and people with pasts and writers and so forth is... it's most damaging. There's far too much of it, and it ought to be stopped. Eustace must not marry this woman.
He may insist on it when he finds her name mentioned unfavorably in the press.
That's no valid reason for having her.
If he insists on having her, then I say let him. But why should he marry her?
What are you suggesting?
We know this type of woman. I'm sure things could be arranged.
If you're suggesting an illicit relationship, it's quite out of the question. There can be no compromise. The thing must be broken off at once. And to that end, I'm prepared to visit this woman and attempt to reason with her. When exactly does Eustace return?
He won't arrive from Eastham for at least 2 hours.
Good. Then there's still time for me to pay a call on Mrs. Noel. I'm an old woman, my dear, so you really mustn't mind what I say about you and my grandson.
Lord Milton's told me how fond he is of you.
He's never mentioned your name to any of us. And if it hadn't been for the unfortunate article in the newspaper, we might not be meeting now.
What is your purpose in coming here, Lady Casterly?
To point out to you that my grandson's name is being coupled with yours in a way that is doing him a great deal of harm. You've seen the story in the paper, of course.
Yes.
Then I need explain no more. I don't know what people have been saying now that they've seen that story.
I wasn't aware that anyone was so interested in my affairs.
Every common person is interested in a woman whose position is anomalous. Living alone as you do, and not a widow, you're fair game for everybody, especially in the country.
Even for you.
If you make mysteries, Mrs. Noel, you must expect the worst interpretation put on them. My grandson is a man of highest principle. He doesn't see things with the eyes of the world. and that should have made you doubly careful not to compromise him, especially at a time like this.
What do you want?
I want a promise that you'll never see my grandson again.
I can't discuss this with you.
I will take nothing less than a statement that anything serious between you is out of the question.
How can you ask such a thing?
Because I love my grandson. And if you love him, you'll promise me you'll give him up.
I can't give you that promise.
Very well, my dear. If you refuse to be reasonable, there's nothing more I can do. But you're sacrificing one of the most brilliant young men in England to your own selfish desires. Now I'll leave, if you please.
This way, Lady Casterly.
This is not the end, Mrs. Noel. Good day.
Good day, Lady Casterly.
Oh, dear heaven. Eustace, what have I done to you? What have I done to you?
Oh, Eustace, I'm so glad to see you. I thought you might never get here.
I came as quickly as I could from Eastham.
Then you haven't been home yet?
No. My father dropped me here, and he went on home alone.
Eustace, take me in your arms.
Why, you're trembling. Audrey, whatever's the matter?
I'm so glad to see you.
But you've been crying, and you look frightened.
I fell asleep. I had a most terrible dream. I'll feel better if I make some tea.
No, no, don't move. Stay here in my arms. Something I've been trying to tell you for days. I love you, Audrey.
Eustace, I love you too. Kiss me because I love you so. Only, now that we've found each other, it's all over.
What do you mean by that?
Then you haven't seen the
newspapers? No, what about
them? They've tried to ruin you. They refer to our being together last evening in the village as Lord Milton's evening adventure with Mrs. Audrey Noel.
Why, the scoundrels. Well, for your sake, I'm sorry. But, my darling, what difference will it make once we're married? I'm sure the divorce was not your fault.
Oh, no. Is that what you think?
Well, don't worry. The divorce can't stand in our way.
Eustace, you don't really think I'm divorced.
What do you mean?
I mean, I thought you knew.
Audrey, I don't understand.
Oh, my darling. Eustace, there's been a dreadful misunderstanding.
What are you driving at?
That I'm still Mrs. Noel. I thought you knew that.
But I thought, everyone thought, because you lived alone, that you were separated.
My husband and I are separated. My husband lives in Clampton, Warwickshire. But we're not divorced.
Well, then we must arrange for a divorce. We'll go to your husband and tell him what you want. Audrey, I love you. I adore you. I'm half out of my mind for you. I must have you for my own.
Please, darling. He won't give me up.
But you can't love the man, and you're living apart. There must be some way. Why did you leave him?
Because we didn't love each other. I married him to please my father when I was hardly more than a girl.
But there must be some way out.
There is no way. My husband's a clergyman, high churchman. For him, there is no divorce.
Oh, no.
I thought you knew all this. I never dreamed you'd want to marry me. I suppose I'd got too used to knowing I was dead.
So, there is to be no release?
Eustace, I'll always love you. And if you love me, why can't we have it that way?
I couldn't have it that way.
If we love each other, what difference can it make?
Love cannot flourish under such circumstances.
Our love's doomed anyway.
What you suggest is hypocrisy. If a man cannot rule himself according to the law, he is not fit to sit in Parliament and administer the law to others.
But, Eustace, no one need know about our being together.
I would know, and I cannot live a lie. Even for my love for you.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you a dramatization of The Patrician by John Galsworthy. If you're interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, Margaret Webster.
If one were to read Galsworthy's The Patrician in isolation from his other work, it would be easy to dismiss the author as a snob and to think an ivory tower his natural habitat. The book is redolent of a Harrow and Oxford education, an independent income, membership of the best clubs, and entree to the best houses. It is enshrined, encased in high society, like a rare ornament under a glass bell. Yet this novel was written in 1911, immediately after his three great plays, Justice, The Silver Box, and Strife, every one of which bitterly attacks the existing social system with its industrial, legal, and moral injustices. It is a far cry from the little lawyer's clerk pacing his prison cell in Justice to the sun and splendor of young Viscount Harbinger. A year or two further back in the chronology of Galsworthy's work, we find still another novel which completes the picture, the first of the Forsyte books, A Man of Property, in which he began an immense saga of the English middle class. Perhaps it may therefore be said that The Patrician forms a part, an essential part, of its author's examination of the whole structure of English society in his day. Cooler and more detached than the rest, less intimate and less emotional, but sensitive and precise recording all the same. It makes curious reading across the space of 40 years, 40 worlds, one would almost say. A dignity has come upon it, as if it were some far-off legend of a vanished, heroic age. The figures of the Caradoc family seem to move against a landscape of dream, larger than life-size, passionate but remote, graceful but a little stiff, austere yet somehow touching. They belong to a world we shall not see again. They belong, perhaps, to the literature of nostalgia. Nevertheless, they are not simply types. Milton, especially, is himself alone, not merely the product of breeding and environment, heredity and tradition. The passion of the heart, the tearing conflict of loyalties, are things which humanity will always experience and suffer. It is easy to scoff at the rigid codes of caste and convention and noblesse oblige, which confine these people and sometimes destroy them. But the high concept of honor and the selfless acceptance of a social discipline, these are things without which no civilization has ever attained greatness. In a final and somewhat formal summation, Galsworthy says, "All are in bond to their own natures, and what a man has most desired shall in the end enslave him." He might have drawn this model for the whole strata of society which The Patrician depicts. It is even a conclusion which we ourselves and our own society might do very well to consider.
Thank you, Margaret Webster. Our radio version of The Patrician will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
Well, Eustace, my boy, you'll have the final vote before too long. How do you feel?
I'm reasonably sure I put up a good fight. Beyond that, I don't know. The early reports are never dependable.
Oh, I think they're an omen. Shrewd move, that idea of yours, having Courtier as a house guest. Helped lay a lot of the bad feeling over you and Mrs. Noel when Courtier quit the campaign. Here he comes now.
Hello there.
Oh, evening, Courtier.
Lord Raleigh's. How's your candidate holding up?
I was just on my way over to his mother and Lady Casterly with that bit of news. Eustace is ahead in the early returns.
Stout fellow.
Now you'll excuse me, I'm sure. The ladies are waiting.
Of course, Lord Raleigh's. Give them my regards.
Join us late if you care to. We are hoping to celebrate.
It's quite a spectacle from up here on the balcony, Lord Milton. All those election torches and the cheers and milling about and all.
Yes, indeed, Cordier. But it's a scene that's hardly inspiring.
You continue to amaze me, Lord Milton. How do you reconcile the mechanics of electioneering with your ideals?
I'm dedicated to my ideals. But when there's a desert between a man and the sacred city, he doesn't renounce his journey because he has to wash in dirty water on the way.
Well, they seem quite fond of you, the mob.
The mob. How I loathe it. I hate its mean stupidities. I hate the sound of its voice and the look on its face. It's so ugly. It's so little. Courtier, I suffer purgatory from the thought that I shall scrape in by the votes of the mob. There is sin in using this creature, and I'm expiating it.
Come now, Lord Milton. The strain of the past weeks has been a little too much, I think. You'll feel better about the mob in the morning. After all, it's made up of men like you and me.
No, Courtier. The mob is not made up of men like you and me. If it were, it would not be the mob.
Look here. If those are honest sentiments, you have no right to be seeking votes. It can be pretty discouraging. I've always stayed clear of it myself. But if you feel like this about politics, then drop it. Don't waste your life following whatever it is you follow. And don't waste Audrey Knowles' life.
Audrey Knowles is in the past. I can only think of the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention.
Oh, they've got the results. Listen.
The votes have been counted and tabulated. Lord Milton, Conservative, 4,898. Chilcox, Liberal, 4,802.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now go out and let them get a good look at you. You belong to them now. Poor devil. I feel sorry for him.
Do you really, Mr. Cordier?
Oh, hello, Lady Barbara. Yes, yes, I do. I feel very sorry for a man who cannot have the woman he loves.
The family heard little from Eustace after the election. He left the country immediately and he went to London, where, to facilitate his attendance in the House of Commons, he took rooms at the Inner Temple. His social appearances were rare indeed. And although diligence is much to be admired in a new member of the government, the young man's solitary life was looked upon with suspicion by at least one member of his family. This person was his grandmother, Lady Casterly, who had stayed on in the country.
Granny, you mustn't worry so. I'm sure everything's all right with you, Steve.
How do we know that, Babs, when we haven't had a letter in weeks?
Well, Father saw him at the League dinner. Said he looked a little tired from work, but otherwise fine.
That was almost a month ago. We haven't had a word since.
Well, just because Eustace doesn't write, that doesn't prove something's wrong. Probably finds his time very much occupied.
Perhaps that's what I'm afraid of.
What do you mean?
Several days ago, I received a very distressing letter from a friend in London.
Was it about Eustace? What did it say?
Mrs. Knowle is back in London.
But I thought she'd gone to the west of England.
Apparently she's returned. For I was even supplied with her address, number 7 Reading Street.
Granny, you don't think that she and Eustace...
I don't know what to think. It isn't that I don't trust Eustace, but ever since that woman came into his life, he hasn't been himself. And now, when he doesn't write, I become frantic.
Why don't you go to him in London?
Little enough I'd find out that way. He'd never tell me if they're together again. But he might tell you, Babs. Your brother's very fond of you.
How could I explain my presence in London?
You might say that you'd come up for a month shopping or some such thing. That would give you a perfect excuse to drop in at his lodgings in the Temple and find out what's happening to the boy.
Yes, ma'am. Are you looking for someone?
Yes, Porter. I'm looking for my brother, Lord Milton.
Indeed, yes, your ladyship. Won't you come inside?
Thank you. I take it my brother is in.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Lord Milton hasn't been out for several days. He just sits there reading, you know. Shall I tell him you're here?
No, thank you. I'll announce myself. I'd like to surprise him.
Very well, your ladyship. It's the third floor back.
Thank you very much. I'll find it. Strange.
I didn't answer because I didn't want to... Oh, it's you, Babs.
Eustace, why didn't you answer?
I was reading.
Oh, how good to see you. I hope I haven't disturbed you.
No, no, it's all right. What are you doing here?
I didn't mean to burst in like this, but when you didn't answer, I thought I'd try the door.
No, I mean, why have you come to London, Babs?
Well, I'd planned to do some shopping.
Ha! Huh. And thought you'd have a little look in to see what I was up to, eh?
Eustace... Are you all right?
Why do you ask?
Because your manner is so strange.
Well, haven't you noticed? The world is very strange. I've been working a great deal. I may be very tired. I have a fever.
Eustace, you are ill. Have you had the doctor?
It's not a case for leeches.
Eustace, let me go for the doctor.
My dear Babs, don't you start telling me what to do.
But the doctor will make you feel better.
I don't want to get better. Go home, hold your tongue, and leave me to burn out in peace.
Oh, my poor brother.
What difference does it make what happens now? The one I love is lost to me. Wherever I turn, her lovable beauty floats before me. The very torture flowers of a beauty never to be grasped. Oh, Babs. I thought I could forget. I thought I could bury myself in my work, but I can't.
You poor darling. Sit down.
Babs, you can't imagine what I've been through since that night I left her at the cottage. There are two men within me, and they're at mortal grips with one another. One, the man of faith in divine sanction and authority on which all my beliefs have been hinged. And the other is a desperate, warm-blooded man in love. What am I to do?
Have you seen Mrs. Noel?
No. But if only I could have her in my arms again. Oh, Babs, I'm sorry, my head.
Sit down, Eustace. I'm not going to leave you. I'll do everything I can for you, Eustace.
Dear Babs.
Now... You must be as quiet as you can while I arrange for a doctor.
Well, thank heaven you came.
But first, I'm going to get you some fresh, cool water.
The sun, the stars, the moon all shrink away. A desert vast without a bound and nothing left to eat or drink. And a dark desert all around.
Good morning, Gertrude.
Good morning, Mother. Sleep well?
Not as well as I might have.
Still worrying about Eustace?
Yes. Babs has been in London for a week now, and she hasn't written.
Ah, now you're too hard on the girl. A letter came from Babs this morning.
Well, what did it say?
I'm sure I don't know. It's addressed to you.
Well, open it, Gertrude. Let me hear what she says about Eustace.
Very well. Mm-hmm. It was written from London yesterday afternoon. Dear Granny, I must tell you what has happened here. Sorry not to have written sooner, but Eustace has been very ill with fever and exhaustion from overwork.
Oh, poor Eustace. I knew something was wrong. How is he? Read on.
He needed a full-time nurse, so I took it upon myself to con... Oh, no, Babs, how could you do such a thing as that?
Let me see that letter.
Babs invited that Mrs. Noel to come and be his nurse. Oh, how could she?
Dear heaven, Mrs. Noel has proved to be an excellent nurse, and Eustace is responding quite well, I dare say.
We can't let him fall victim to her a second time, and yet I suppose we can't just barge in there and ask her to leave.
Just listen to this. Thanks to Mrs. Noel's gentle care, Eustace should be completely well in another 10 days or so. By tomorrow, he should be up and around the garden.
What are we going to do?
I don't know about you, Gertrude, but I'm going to London.
He won't listen to you.
Eustace won't even know I've been there until it's too late.
The sun has done you a world of good, Eustace. You look much better for being outside.
And I feel better, my dear. But let's be honest, it's not the sun's fault. It's because of you and the care you've given me.
Come now, don't flatter the nurse. She's on to you.
Oh, I'm quite serious, my dear. And now that you've saved my life, I wish that you might share it with me.
Oh, Eustace, you know that can't be.
Listen to me. You and I were meant for each other. Every minute we spend together convinces me of the truth of that. We love each other, and we'll never be happy apart. I didn't want to leave you that night at the cottage.
I didn't want you to go, Eustace. I told you then I'd be yours. My love for you hasn't changed.
Oh, my darling, my darling.
Hold me in your arms.
My sweet.
No one need ever know about me. I'll be as still as a shadow. No one in Parliament will ever guess about me.
No, it cannot be that way.
Then what other way is there? You know he'll never give me a divorce.
Not if we stay in England. But you could get a divorce easily if we went abroad to live.
But we can't live abroad. You're a member of Parliament.
No, not while I'm a member.
Eustace, what are you suggesting?
I cannot live a lie. What right have I to sit in Parliament and lead? A man is a churl who imposes laws when he himself has not the strength to observe them. I will not be one of whom it is said he can rule others.
Oh, no. You wouldn't give up your seat.
There's no question in my mind. I don't happen to regard life as divided into public and private departments. And so, as an elected representative of the people, who happens to be very much in love, I shall tonight write out my resignation. So it is that I must, in all good faith and conscience, resign my seat. And, yes, come in.
Gentlemen, see you, Lord Milton. Mr. Courtier is the name.
Well, old Courtier, show him in by all means.
Yes, my lord.
And if you'll come up after the gentleman leaves, I'll have a letter for you to put in the post.
Very good, my lord. This way, sir.
Thank you.
Come in, Courtier. Good to see you.
How are you, Lord Milton?
Better, thank you. Have a chair. I was just about to make myself a drink. Will you join me?
I'd be delighted.
Scotch or Irish? Which will you have?
Irish, if you don't mind. I can't stay long, but I wanted to drop in before I go abroad tomorrow.
I didn't know you were leaving England. Where are you bound for?
I'm off to Persia for a revolution. You might call it a business trip. My business, anyway.
Well, here's your drink. And I wish you luck.
Thank you. We might make this a farewell toast for both of us.
Well, hold on a minute. What do you mean?
Well, I'm leaving England, and you're leaving Parliament.
Now, where did you hear that?
Audrey told me. I dropped in to see her, too, tonight. She's more than a little upset, Milton. Do you think you're doing the right thing in resigning?
In what respect?
Well, if you give up your public work and make yourself unhappy, Audrey's life will be spoiled for a second time.
Would you rather I continue in Parliament and make Audrey my mistress without acknowledgement as my wife?
And why not? How many men are there into whose lives there has not entered some such relationship at one time or another? Your ideals would disqualify half the nation.
You may very well be right. But could you honestly follow your own advice?
Yes. Considering the antiquated inhuman divorce law, which enforces spiritual adultery on those who have come to hate their mates, and destroys the sanctity of the married state, the very sanctity it professes to uphold. In face of such a law, I say that you must expect to have it broken by reasoning men and women, and without losing self-respect.
Oh, come now, Courtier. What you suggest is an attack upon authority.
May I ask, what is your conception of authority?
Strangely enough, God. Working through the medium of the best men who comprise a central force.
You sound like an ancient high priest.
I'm quite serious. Since the beginning of the world, the best man has been the medium of authority, the medium of the controlling principle, the divine force. He felt the power within him. He used it to take the lead and has held it ever since, to rule, to govern.
Good heavens. Do you really believe all this?
Look at the world about us. The best men cannot be prevented from coming to the top. For the best men stand nearest to the deity and are the first to receive the waves that come from him.
Lord Milton, I cannot see how anything can be served by my challenging your convictions, but in view of the philosophy which you express, may I ask, what will you be doing to yourself by giving up your seat and going away?
You too are leaving London. Doesn't that mean you're giving up something?
Yes. Whatever chances I may have had with your sister, Lady Barbara. But there was no future at all for us. The radical leader, the cabinet minister's daughter. So, drink up, since tomorrow we die.
You mean, I suppose, that public life is the breath of my nostrils and I must die because I give it up?
Yes.
I thank you, sir, for your concern. And now, if you'll forgive me, I'm suddenly quite fatigued by our conversation. I would like to be alone.
By all means.
I hope you have a good voyage.
And you, sir.
Will you let yourself out? And tell the porter he needn't bother to come up for the letter. It can wait.
Eustace sat by the window and looked out through the night across the rooftops of London, towards Westminster and the towers of Parliament. It has been said that the love of those towers passed into the blood, and that he who had sat in office beneath them would never again be quite the same.
It's true. It's so desperately true. I was born to lead. In person, I sat on the benches but a few short weeks. But in soul, I've been there hundreds of years. And now I shall sit there no more. What is this rising within me? This treasonable desire to free myself from this coil in which I've entangled myself. I'm a prisoner to authority. Unable to wield authority because to wield authority is to insult it. How now will I live out my doomed life? And what of her, for whom I bartered away my real life? Audrey, you've got to help me.
Good evening, Lord Milton. Won't you come in?
Thank you. Will you tell Mrs. Noel that I've come to call?
I'm afraid that's impossible, Your Lordship. Mrs. Noel is no longer with us.
I beg your pardon?
The lady no longer lives here, sir.
But that can't be. I know she was home earlier in the evening. I can't believe you.
Oh, I beg your pardon, Lord Milton. Mrs. Noel has moved away. She left with her personal baggage less than an hour ago.
This is some trick. She's home and you know it. I saw the light when I walked through the gate.
Oh, to be sure, my lord, there is a light. But when Mrs. Noel left, another lady remained behind to supervise the packing, I would say.
Who is this woman?
I wasn't on duty when she called, my lord, so I didn't get the name. But when Mrs. Noel left, I noticed she was considerably older than Mrs. Noel. A tiny little lady in grey.
Down, Eustace. Calm yourself.
Why did you send her away?
I did not send Mrs. Noel anywhere. She left of her own free will because she saw the folly of being in love with you. She knew that you couldn't live without your career.
Is that so terrible compared to a career without the woman I love?
For you, Eustace, yes. Mrs. Noel realized that deep within you, your career was more important than your love.
These are your words, not hers. She loved me.
And because of her love for you, she knew what she would become in your life. The destroyer of your usefulness. Not the helpmate, but the clog. Not the inspiring sky, but the clouds.
I don't believe it. We'd planned for a lifetime together. And then you came here tonight and put those ideas into her head.
I only reminded her of what she already knew in her heart. And she confessed to me that your decision to give up your career for her love filled her with a sense of disaster.
But what of my love for her?
She was afraid of your love, Eustace. She knew that before long, as you began more and more to miss your career, you would feel her love maiming you. And even if you went on desiring her, it would be only with your body. She was well aware that if you were capable of giving up your career because you loved her, you would be capable of living with her after your love had died.
Say no more. It would seem that I've not known my own mind in this matter. And she has been the innocent victim of my folly.
Eustace, you were cut out for a statesman, not a lover. There's something dried up in you. I'm not sure there isn't something dried up in all our caste. She's gone now, and she'll never come back. The interlude is over. Now you're free. The future is your own once more, Eustace. Put on your armor, boy.
A grim little smile played on Lady Casterly's pale lips. Eustace was safe, and in time he would be happy. Eustace would rise now to that pinnacle of desired authority which he had dreamed of and planned for ever since, as a tiny thing, his thin brown hand had first clasped hers, reaching for guidance. But what of the man before her, bent in sorrow? Memories played upon his mind, and within him rose a yearning for love, profounder, more terrible than ever, because now, defeated, it would soon never more stir, but lie forever dead. As Eustace realized that character is fate, and learned the universal truth that all men are bound to their own natures, and what a man has desired most in life shall in the end enslave him.
You have been listening to The Patrician, an NBC theater production of the novel by John Galsworthy. If you wish to increase your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest that you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC theater. For full information, write to NBC Theater in care of one of the following universities or colleges: the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky; the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma; Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas; Washington State College, Pullman, Washington; the University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona; Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas; and Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. You also have a chance to win a set of the famous Encyclopedia Britannica. Several of the universities and colleges offering these courses are giving the Encyclopedia as prizes to the students doing the best work. Enroll in a supervised course, and you may be one of the fortunate ones to win the Encyclopedia Britannica. Be with us at the NBC Theater next week for a dramatization of the highly amusing Tono Bungay by H.G. Wells, and the following week for a radio version of There Is No Conversation by Rebecca West. The Patrician was adapted for the NBC Theater by Richard E. Davis. Our intermission commentator was Margaret Webster, whose commentary was recorded. In today's cast, Ramsey Hill was the narrator, Robin Hughes was Eustace. Donald Morrison was Courtier. Monty Margetts was Audrey. Norma Varden was Lady Casterly. Eric Snowden was Lord Valleys. Marna Keneally was Babs. Doris Lloyd, Lady Valleys. Alec Harford was Smythe. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. What's on NBC today? There's a great program in store for you today with Kirk Douglas and Walter Houston on Theater Guild on the Air. The play is Heaven Can Wait, which was filmed as the motion picture Here Comes Mr. Jordan. And for more comedy, be sure to listen to the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show today. Sunday on NBC means listening enjoyment. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.